Welcome to Cloud at Microsoft Subject Matter Expert, or SME, Roundtable. Hi, I'm Sherry Bettine, and I'll be your host. We are the IT Showcase team, and we love to talk to you, our customers, about how Microsoft does IT. Today, I'm here with many of our IT experts that work with cloud-based technologies here at Microsoft. This is your opportunity to ask direct questions of our SMEs and receive candid answers. We'd like to learn a little bit about you as well, so we've posted a question into your Q&A window that we would like to know the answer of. As you answer that question, your answers will appear on a monitor in front of us, and it'll help shape how we answer your questions. To get us started, I would like our experts to introduce themselves. And we'll start with you, Jared.
Thanks, Sherry. My name is Jared Shockley. I'm a senior service engineer within Microsoft IT, and I'm helping Microsoft IT move to the cloud on Azure, Office 365, and Dynamics 365.
Hi, I'm Robert Venable. I am a software, principal software architect for Microsoft IT. I concentrate on how do we take advantage of new business capabilities as we move to Azure, and how we deliver those capabilities to our business.
Hi, and I'm Joe Mazzotta. I'm a senior program manager in Microsoft IT, and I help consult internal and external teams on accelerating their adoption of Azure.
Hi, I'm Brent Burtness. I'm a senior program manager as well, and I help drive the IT Azure strategy as well as the optimization when you're in Azure.
You can start posting your questions now into your chat window. And also, if you have feedback for our product groups, please post that there as well. We'll make sure it gets to the product teams. We'll make every effort in the next hour to get through all of your questions. However, if we don't, we'll stay behind in the studio and continue answering questions till we get through them all. And we'll post that extended footage along with this video on Microsoft.com/IT Showcase. With that, we'll get started. What is the biggest changes you are seeing with cloud adoption from your traditional on-premise solution?
I think part of the, or one of the biggest changes I see is the ability to take advantage of new capabilities that Azure offers. For example, the elasticity, the scale out is something that, you know, it's hard to do on-prem, right? You go through that procurement cycle. From a skill perspective, the services are changing quite frequently, and so there is a need to do continuous learning and understand the new capabilities as they're released so fast. So I think from a skills perspective, understanding how to use the cloud and understanding the new capabilities that the cloud actually offers is probably the biggest things I see, right?
And in the old world, we would buy a server that would suit maximum capacity, like at peak loads,
right?
How is it different today?
So if you use concepts like infrastructure as code, where you can spin up environments as you need them, you don't need to go through this big, long procurement cycle and buy the peak load hardware. You can actually use the cloud's elasticity, whether it be a VM or whether it be a PaaS service, to actually scale out or scale up even when your seasonality hits. So say, for the holiday season, if you have some kind of shopping cart, you can actually predict that you're gonna need bigger services or a bigger SKU. And you can just basically go through there and spin them up. And then when the peak load is down, you can actually spin it back down to a smaller size and hopefully get the financial rewards, right?
Could you explain a little bit about infrastructure as code?
Yeah, infrastructure as code. So using something like Azure Resource Manager allows you to spin up resource groups within Azure. Those services can be spun up within minutes. So I can spin up a VM in a minute. I can spin up a SQL database in a minute. And then apply your build on top of that. So if you think about the dev process, a traditional dev process is I have my dev environment, test environment, UAT environment, I have all these different environments, and I bought hardware for all these things. Now I don't need to do that. I basically just spend, when I need a test environment, I spin up the test environment as part of my build, as part of the code deployment, and then when I'm done with my test cases or whatever I need to do, then I can shut it back down and it doesn't remain static, it doesn't cost me anything. I can manage those ARM templates, for example, in as code, because it's really just JSON and PowerShell.
One of the great aspects about that is you get repeatability as you build those environments. It'll always be the same, no matter what environment you deploy to, if it's a test environment or even production. You'll get the same exact environment every time, which helps make the services run better.
Yeah. I remember getting bugs on just configuration issues when you thought you had the server set up exactly like the last one.
Exactly. That's one of the configuration drift has been a major problem for IT professionals and developers for over many years. And being able to utilize ARM templates is going to be one of the aspects that people should embrace and enjoy.
Go ahead. It's also one of the primary pillars around cost savings. If you think about traditional IT, as Robert was saying, you have a data center, you provision hardware, the hardware's amortized or it's sitting there, you've bought for peak load, and so you may have a couple dev environments per application, you may have a couple test environments, you'll have a pre-production environment, you may have a performance environment, and then you've got your production environment. So very quickly, you're at seven environments that are replicas of each other for a single application, and it's, you know, all of that hardware, the database, the network layer, all of that infrastructure is sitting there. And so the ability, at least for Microsoft IT, we've seen significant cost savings in the ability to rationalize environments and then spin them up in the cloud only when we need them.
And then spin them back down.
And then spin them back down, yeah.
Yep. Exactly, yeah, good, great point.
Made your point exactly. Great. How secure is Azure? How much of the financial industry in the U.S. is using Azure? Do we know that?
I don't know if we have current numbers, but I know several financial companies are using Azure. If you go to, I believe it's there's a part of the Azure.com website talks about all of the certifications that they've gotten over the years. There's a lot of certifications. One that I know because I used to work in healthcare, they have is they sign BAAs or business associate agreements for HIPAA, meaning healthcare companies can put healthcare data on Azure. In my mind, if healthcare companies can do that, Azure's pretty secure.
Yeah, I can kind of take some of this. So one of my main areas of responsibility is financial applications. And we are moving all of our financial applications to the cloud. I don't know of any that are actually staying behind from a security standpoint.
What percentage are we at? Do you know?
We're probably, Brent,
I'd say we're 90%.
90%, right.
In the cloud?
Yes. And in addition, we're also, from a finance standpoint of view, we're actually thinking about the modernization of a lot of our finance apps, right? So our finance apps were, some of our finance apps were built when Microsoft was younger and therefore have some teeth or, you know, they've been around a while. So we're actually having to re-envision some of these things. And so there's a couple of blogs out there I can actually point people to that talk about how we moved our tax systems, our tax calculation systems into the cloud, as well as our revenue reporting systems into the cloud and the journey that we're actually moving.
Are they on the IT Showcase site?
I believe they are.
Microsoft.com, IT Showcase. Sounds good.
If I can add a point on the security aspect, I think for customers, it's important to understand that, think of Azure in terms of below the line, below the fabric controller is the physical infrastructure that Microsoft provides to customers. And that's extremely secure, all the way from our data centers have the strongest level of security, biometrics, and as Jared mentioned, numerous certifications attesting to the security and compliance of our infrastructure below the Fabric Controller. Now, above the Fabric Controller is where you're interacting either with Azure Portal, or you're interacting with the REST API, or you're interacting with Azure CLI or Azure PowerShell to provision resources. In that particular case, you really have to think about the securing the data, securing the endpoints. These are the endpoints that if you provision your web application in Azure and your endpoints available to everyone without authentication and it's wide open, then that effectively can be unsecured. There are many layers of Azure capabilities as well as Azure Marketplace capabilities where you can provision virtual capabilities from third-party vendors that will allow you to completely lock down both your workload and then ensure that Microsoft is keeping your data secured.
And one other thing I'd like to add there is, you know, with Azure Security Center or any of these other things you can add to increase your security, sometimes it's a simple checkbox that all you need to do is check it.
Right?
Yep.
So just keep that in mind, is just check that checkbox and that'll help keep you secure.
You do need to think about your security a little differently than you think about it today. And when you basically own your infrastructure, you own your data center, right? So you really need to think about it from an application level. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the part of that continuous learning. That you know, there's great capabilities, but you also have to make sure that you understand what ports you're leaving open, those kind of things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. Segmentation also becomes critical as well. You can absolutely segment in Azure. So you can segment by VNet, you can segment by resource group, you can even segment by subscription. And so if you've got sensitive information versus information that is completely available to the public, you can, Azure provides you the capabilities to completely segment your data, as encrypt your data, encrypt it at rest, encrypted in transit,
Very good. What will be the best to choose in between IaaS and PaaS for migrating the applications? Probably many of us have thoughts on that.
So I think Joe was speaking about this earlier, which is we actually have a priority of how we think about migration of apps. We actually think about, well, to be real honest, we think about retire first, right? And then we think about do we need that capability, or can that capability be joined with another app? The second one, we think about SaaS or software as a service, and then PaaS, and then we actually fall back to IaaS as probably it's probably considered a fallback at this point.
The last resort.
Right? The last resort. We were talking earlier, it's about some of our legacy apps where you don't have a whole lot of investment, then IaaS makes a lot of sense, as well as things maybe like containers, et cetera. But for most stuff that you're going to do heavy investment is, I would highly encourage you to take advantage of the PaaS and SaaS.
If you're going to already be writing code.
Yeah, you crack the code open, you're going to make some investment in it. And so you should look at what advantages the cloud can give you, right? Mm-hmm. And not polishing hardware is one of those advantages.
Yeah. Absolutely, yeah. So as I work with both internal teams and external customers, with external customers, leverage your Microsoft account team. If you've got a cloud solution architect assigned, leverage your cloud solution architect to take a look and perform an assessment and help the enterprise really understand. I think if you're trying to decide between IaaS and PaaS, there is a natural prioritization that the industry is really gravitating towards. But really understand your goals. You want to understand your company goals, company strategy for the cloud. You also want to factor in, as Robert was saying, the skill sets within the team. And so fundamentally, the reason why SaaS and PaaS make sense is because you're offloading your operational effort or your overhead, you're offloading that to your cloud provider. And so you're getting capabilities effectively for free. Things like scaling, things like right-sizing, things like auto shutdown, restart, just native capabilities with PaaS where you're not having to control the VM, you're not having to patch the VM. You're not having to set maintenance windows and schedule change releases. And so it alleviates you from a lot of IT overhead by going to SaaS and PaaS. However, IaaS is there because there's some criteria where if it's a legacy application, there's no investment. And there's also scenarios where you need that control. You absolutely need the control when a change happens. You need the control around the availability of the individual VM, where you may want to go to an IaaS VM.
Yeah, I would say that one thing that we would want to make sure that, you know, we portray back out is when you're choosing, if you choose to do a SaaS or, you know, a SaaS migration, which is a natural first step to get your feet kind of wet within the cloud, don't take your on-premise configurations as the as the gospel, so to speak. Your on-prem, you know, servers usually are built, or if you're like most of us, they're probably not, they're running under 10% utilization, and so use some of the tools that, you know, that you can actually resize as you move. Don't just basically, because I have 32 cores on-prem, I need that 32 core VM. It's not necessarily true, and so I would make sure you did that.
The other point I would add there is, if you do need to move to IaaS, don't just take everything that's on-premise today and move that up to IaaS, where when we did the activity with MSIT, there was 30% of our on-prem infrastructure that we could simply delete. You know, it's unused, didn't need it. Let's not migrate that up. Let's just move up what we need.
So you must have had a way to identify that, right? What was not being used?
We did. So what we did was we basically inventoried every server, attached a plan, a migration plan to each server, each application. And at the end of the day, after that exercise, we did find that 30% could simply get deleted. Mm-hmm. They're unused. Once you know your inventory, and I'm sure this is a common problem, not knowing what you even have, right? Yeah. So once you know what you have, it's a good opportunity to just do some cleanup.
But that sounds like what we did also with SharePoint.
Yep.
We had people clean house, or we didn't envision shifting everything to the cloud.
Correct.
You want to talk about what we did?
Well, when we moved SharePoint from on-prem to the cloud, we took the team sites, which were the standard SharePoint site type, and we took them, we first did a process to validate that they were all in use still. And the ones that hadn't been touched for years, we would just archive off, and we used our governance system to find those. Once we found and got that set down to what needed to move to the cloud, that's when we actually started the migration of sites, and we took them by the most active to the least active, so that we had a chance with the least active to maybe get rid of more of them at the end. It truly worked out well in that case when we were moving the utility sites like that.
If I can add one thing, so we've been talking about assessments and understanding portfolio, understanding what to move, when to move it. One of the key things also for enterprise customers to understand is you don't have to be waiting around while you're doing the assessment. It's an iterative process, and so you can kick off an assessment, and as you're discovering and making decisions around your portfolio, you can immediately start moving. You don't have to wait and complete the entire assessment. And so at least for Microsoft IT and many successful companies that have gone to the cloud, it's an iterative process where you start understanding workloads. As soon as you understand them and make a decision around the destination, then you just can immediately start moving. Getting that exploration and experimentation is absolutely vital and critical to understanding how to operate in the cloud more effectively.
And not only that, you're getting the employees and the team members learning about the new technologies, and if you can hit it, if you can get to the cloud on low-hanging fruit, the easier items. For example, MSIT, we've been moving a lot of smaller, lower, you know, less intense systems. Now we're starting to get to the point we're getting the core of our systems. And then in our next fiscal year, we're going to move SAP. SAP moving to the cloud for Microsoft IT is a major endeavor. But because we've already laid a lot of groundwork, this is not going to be that difficult as it would have been 2 years ago. 2 years ago, we were like, oh, we can't do this. This is too much. Now it's like, hey, yeah, we can do this.
Was there any service interruption reported before from the customer? So I guess across our different migrations to the cloud, what do we remember about disruptions?
So, you know, we've had disruptions, usually through some of it our fault and some of it not our fault.
So give us a few examples.
not having a good inventory. We deleted a server that probably shouldn't have been deleted. I think that might happen.
We thought it wasn't being used.
Oops.
I think out of 3,000 servers, I deleted 3 and 2 caused major incidents.
Right. So those are our fault. You know, we're held to the same Azure service SLAs as, you know, everyone else. And so there have been a few outages. But I would caveat that and say all hardware fails, mm-hmm. Whether it's your own hardware or some other hardware. What Azure does a really great job at is focusing on making sure that things stay up and are available. It's really hard to get 4.9s when you're on your on-prem. Azure routinely hits 4.9s.
That's what.
The thing I would add there is, it's for PaaS and geo redundancy. It's yet another checkbox.
It's a checkbox
that sometimes people forget to check.
Yeah. Yep.
So it's some on the application team to actually ensure that their application is set up for geo redundancy or redundancy, which is another thing that oftentimes teams forget to do.
Recovery time is another thing, right? So we focus a lot, is there been a outage, right? And you know, there has been outages, some of our fault, but the recovery time, because you can spin up an additional resource mm-hmm. within minutes, is really fantastic.
Yeah. One of the things we're moving to in my specific organization within MSIT, one of the teams is actually looking to be able to engage and say, oh, we have an incident going on. First step that they're going to do is build a new environment. And then they're time boxed because the build is about 2.5 hours. They now have 2.5 hours to fix this major incident. And if they don't fix it in that 2.5 hours, they fail over to the new environment and start working again. And then they can go back and spend time and do problem management, figure out what exactly the root cause was. Yeah. And that's a whole different change in mindset. And that's what the cloud gives us.
Yeah. It is a mindset change. I was going to add, I think the other advantage that we had at Microsoft IT is executive sponsorship. And so to the question around, you know, have we had service disruptions in the cloud? Absolutely. Were our execs, you know, understanding that was going to happen? Yeah, absolutely, and supportive of our process to mitigate and then resolve and get the service back online. Couple things that I think we should mention here in terms of service disruption is also a culture change in terms of going to live site. So traditionally what would happen on-prem was we would have a help desk, and our help desk would manage the incident. It would go through our tier 1, tier 2, tier 3. Eventually, if it was it needed involvement from the application engineering teams, they would get involved. Whereas, if you know, again, part of that mindset change, thinking about Azure, is understanding that your live site team will get involved immediately. Having telemetry, really tight telemetry around the components of your application, being understand where you're seeing that service disruption, what type of service disruption, and then how to mitigate that is absolutely critical. You'll find faster response times with a culture change and then tracking that tight telemetry.
Absolutely.
What are the things we need to evaluate before we move from on-premises to Azure?
I would say in all aspects of the cloud, figure out what applications you absolutely still need. That's the first thing. We've had systems where we found out there was only 5 people using a system worldwide. Why do we, you know, all of a sudden it was a reporting system. There's plenty of reporting systems that we have. So we were able to show these 5 users a different reporting system that actually was newer and faster. They got better results. We were able to shut down the system. The other thing is don't be hesitant to look at SaaS providers. Companies, you know, even Microsoft, we are a group of engineers and we could probably engineer anything. But are we the best people to engineer HR products? When you have actual companies that engineer HR products out there, they are very niche type of deployments and niche type of business offerings. And it's difficult for a generic IT team to develop those kind of systems.
Plus, it's not our core competency.
Correct.
We're not in the business of HR.
Yeah.
It's
exactly.
just something we need to do to run our business.
Now, the IT team is going to have to connect to those systems. So there is going to be a responsibility to help manage the connectivity, make sure that the SaaS provider is doing all the correct things per your requirements of security, of privacy of the data, as well as being able to get data to and from them in any case. So there's still an aspect for IT to manage. You're just not developing the core product. And in a lot of cases, I know I've talked with some folks who are like, especially even with cloud providers or with SaaS providers, what happens if they go down? Like we've said, service outages do happen.
Even on-prem they happen.
Even on-prem. Mm-hmm. When you're dealing with a provider, help them to enable the system faster. Help them provide good feedback, be able to help them. If you see something that's happening, mm-hmm. provide that feedback. They want that feedback.
Yeah. I would add as well, when you're doing the assessment, you know, think about how you want to operate in the future, not how you've operated in the past. So for example, you may have your SQL Server on-prem, which could easily move to SQL in IaaS, but you can also move to SQL in PaaS, which is a lot less overhead for you to manage. So make sure you're using the right technology for the solution that you're building, rather than trying to use something that you've used in the past and are familiar with.
That's part of the capabilities that something like Azure Services gives you a way to rethink how you build and how your applications are architected, right?
So it also gives you a chance to try newer technologies. I mean, I know Microsoft IT is a very SQL heavy organization, and we now have people trying things like NoSQL databases and trying data lakes and trying these alternate data. I know you work
a lot in the data sciences. Yeah.
And it's brand new for us because we're so T-SQL, SQL oriented. Yeah. It's like, wow, we can do all these new things.
Yeah.
I know there's a group over in the Skype for Business team taking in all the data, and they were trying to take in all the data into a SQL server, migrate it to an AS cube to do analysis. It was actually faster for them to use Hadoop as the midpoint. And they could process a lot more data, and we could get better metrics.
To that point, both of, I think I mentioned earlier, there's a tax system that we moved to Azure. It is actually using Hadoop.
Awesome.
And then our revenue reporting is actually using Spark.
Excellent.
And so when we think about moving applications, in this particular case, the finance applications, we're evaluating the full gamut of what Azure offers, not just the Microsoft-specific pieces.
And not what you're comfortable with. You stretch out into new things.
Yeah, we have to stretch out. And so that you need to be cognizant of your team's skill set. You know, there's a lot of people out there that already have an open source skill set, and that's great. And then there's teams that may be more of not, they don't have an open source skill set. And so it's basically an opportunity to stretch and grow your teams as well as take advantage of new capabilities.
Exactly.
So what are some things that you're doing now that's different from when you started on our journey to Azure?
So, yeah, that's a great question. So when we started the journey to Azure, we mostly did a lift and shift from on-prem to IaaS with the 30% reduction of what we deleted. But what we did at the time was we essentially treated IaaS as an extension of on-prem, where we had our central ops team essentially provision the VMs for us, hand them over to the project teams to use. Yeah. Mm-hmm. You know, that became a bottleneck, and manageability was with the central ops team. Now we're kind of moving away from that, where we hand the subscription off to the project team, ownership off to the project team, and let them kind of manage their own VMs, the infrastructure as code type things. They manage security on their sub. They manage all aspects of the subscription. So it's kind of that skill set change as well, where they now need to know, you know, how to set up the network, how to configure the VM, how to install SQL Server, where a lot of that stuff was previously managed by central ops.
Yeah. And we do make it easier for teams at Microsoft to apply standards through ARM templates.
Yeah.
And so Azure provides capability where there's JSON templates that you can codify your IT standards, you can codify your network policy, you can codify your security policy, and then you can ensure compliance against those policies. So enterprises can be comfortable with having a DevOps culture and allowing application or engineering teams to directly provision and directly manage resources in Azure while ensuring that the compliance standards and network are secured, and they're secured to the company's policies.
Make sure we have those guardrails around.
The guardrails, yeah.
What was the most challenging aspect of cloud adoption for Microsoft?
I think the toughest part actually was getting the mindset change in all the MSIT employees. One of the biggest problems as you start moving to the cloud is getting rid of that old on-prem mindset. One story I love sharing is we had a team that was deploying databases for their project, and they deployed them in August on Azure, but the actual application deployment was in November. I went and talked with them. I said, so how easy was it to deploy those databases? Oh, it was real easy to deploy. Oh, and they realized, okay, I'm sitting here with all these unused databases, so I better go delete them, and then I'll redeploy them in November right before we go to production. It's trying to get them to rethink and change from a hoarding mentality, because we were some of the worst hoarders of both systems and data, to now embracing newer technologies.
Well, to be fair, it took a long time to get a server. And also, it took a long time to set up environments and to load it. So they were being proactive.
In the past, they were. Now they're being wasteful. Yeah. And I remember being one of those hoarders. I remember every time I bought a new server, it's like, okay, yeah, we could take that one out of the rack, but send it to the lab, just so we have a spare in the lab. Just because it's still a good server. It's only 4 years old.
And if you got rid of it, you'd have to replace it later on.
Exactly.
Yeah.
No, technically we did replace it. That was the problem. We had already replaced it with a brand new server, but we just stuffed it someplace so we could use it again.
Yeah.
And one of the things that I noticed is kind of a general fear of change itself and actually what Azure could offer. But as teams start to get into the portal themselves, start to experiment and see what actually Azure can offer, there's a lot that Azure can do, right, that they couldn't do
on-prem.
Exactly. So it's a lot more freedom. It's just getting over that initial fear and actually letting people know the benefits and what they can actually do has really helped us out a lot.
I love explaining. One of my favorite ways to explain PaaS services to our employees is, do you want to still patch servers and patch SQL? Nope. Okay. Let's move to PaaS, because then you don't have to patch servers and you don't have to patch SQL. And all of that gets almost immediate movement from teams that have web apps of some sort, or has a web app and a database. And then they start branching into, well, maybe I could redesign this with a web service and use a NoSQL database, and I could save this money. And it starts them expanding.
Okay. What are some of the biggest differences that you have encountered with running IT workloads in IaaS or VM-based environments versus running in SaaS or Azure?
So similar to a lot of the conversation we've already had, Jared brought up a great example, and it's an example that I use with internal teams and with customers, which is, at the end of the day, if fundamentally you don't want the control and overhead of managing a physical resource or a virtual machine, and you're okay with running your web application on Azure Web App, and you're okay with running your back end on an Azure data store, whether it's NoSQL, whether it's relational database, and you can achieve your company's objectives, you can achieve the workload objectives and the KPIs for the workload, and you're not interested in any of that overhead, that IT overhead, then absolutely the right course is to take a look at SaaS and PaaS. And so the big difference there is, if you absolutely need control right down to the component level and down to availability and how you're going to architect the VM itself, then absolutely the ISVM is there as a choice. However, if you're not interested in that level of overhead and you don't need it and that's not part of your goal, then take a look at SaaS and PaaS.
ahead.
Oh, I was going to add that some of our IaaS lift and shifts were because we needed to vacate a data center by a timeline. We were given be out by May or whatever. So sometimes it's a time-based decision.
It is, and our management was completely, our executives were understanding that we would end up going through multiple hops. And what I mean by that is we're going to vacate on-prem, we're going to go to IaaS, and then we're going to spend effort and go to maybe Azure Web Apps or Azure App Services or Azure Service Fabric. And so that was acceptable to Microsoft IT, whereas other companies may want to, they may not have a time pressure to get out of a data center at a particular time. Mm-hmm. They may have a longer runway where they want to be a little bit more pragmatic about their final destination and just going directly to their final destination.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I was just gonna point out that a lot of the PaaS services, Service Fabric, et cetera, SQL DB, the advantage is it's quite freeing not to have to worry about the hardware underneath. And so, you know, the trend is actually serverless architecture and serverless components. And so, I just think that if we can get away from it's a kind of a blanket where if I can get away from having to actually worry about the hardware, it opens up that time that you spend doing that to actually trying to provide more business value, right? So this is how I can use this, and I can maybe apply an ML algorithm that will provide business value rather than worrying about patching a server.
Isn't that one of the freeing aspects when you start moving to PaaS services? Is just the fact you can focus on that user experience
and the
business
the fun stuff.
Exactly. Yeah. Office 365 is actually the same way as Azure. As you start moving, you're no longer Exchange server or Exchange administrators aren't managing databases and the endpoints. You have SharePoint engineers instead of patching servers and managing database splits and all that, they can focus on actually providing business value. They can focus on, do we need to enable more e-discovery or DLP, data loss prevention systems. They can focus on those. I even know the Microsoft IT SharePoint admins right now are spending a ton of time working with LinkedIn as a part of the purchase of LinkedIn. They can focus on combining our collaboration systems instead of having to focus on patching a server and splitting databases. And, I got to spend this time with LinkedIn trying to get them in. They can focus and do a better job of that integration of LinkedIn to our core collaboration systems.
The one other thing I'd like to add there is one of the primary differences that we're seeing between the SQL on IaaS and SQL PaaS is, again, the decentralization, where the engineers may not know necessarily how to configure and how to set up and tune a SQL database on IaaS. Where in SQL PaaS, again, it's just a checkbox, right? It automatically creates the indexes. It automatically does a lot of stuff for you. So again, to the points that they're making, the engineer can just focus on engineering rather than figuring out how to maintain and manage their SQL server.
I had to laugh. I know one person that was like, I need to encrypt my databases.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm encrypted.
Done.
They're done.
Very good.
Yeah.
So you do get to work on the more interesting or the funner problems, I think.
Yes.
Can you please give high-level architecture of Azure?
Wow.
That's a large topic.
It's fairly open.
It is. I think the way to think about it is Azure has several data centers within regions around the world. They have systems there that are all interconnected through the Azure Fabric, and it's all software defined. Now, the great thing that Azure has done over the time has been they've made things like switches agnostic. So they have a multitude of Juniper, Cisco, Dell, all these different switch manufacturers. You don't have to know as you're building, for example, your own networking. When in Azure, you can develop your own networking for your subscriptions. You don't have to know iOS from Cisco or the Juniper OS or the Dell OS. You just say, I want this networking to work this way. And the Azure Fabric then deploys it across the fabric the way you need it. Now, the fabric can work either to create virtual machines so that you have control from the OS up, or the PaaS services where it's you deploy your code and it just runs. So, I mean, from a high level, that's kind of what Azure does.
No, I mean, I don't think there's much to add.
No.
So it's a large topic.
It is.
I think we can find some resource material to kind of to help.
Mark Rusinovich has had a couple of great talks on it. I bet they're recorded on Channel 9.
There's so many different services that Azure offers.
Oh, yeah.
It's really hard. I kind of specialize in the data side.
Yeah.
But there's so much more.
But everything's based off that fabric that they've built.
Yeah.
And that's the key part, is they build on top of their own fabric.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
For their services. And that's been the key a lot for them and being able to provide those services.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's right. Yeah, so at last count, I believe there was 39 Azure sites and regions.
Mm-hmm.
So in terms of architecture, another thing to consider is that if you're traversing Azure, you're using the Azure backbone.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a huge advantage. And then to what Robert was saying, at last count, there's over 80 different Azure services, everything from compute services to data store services to caching services to networking services. Yeah, and so architecture in Azure ends up being a very broad topic, and I think we'd need a, you know, if the audience member wants to submit a more specific question, we could answer that. The other thing.
Where would he go for information? Does Azure?
Azure.com
is a great starting point.
Azure.
I know it lists all the services there, which is really inundating, but they have several places where you can go and start and say, okay, compute as this, okay. And like I said, another great resource is the Microsoft Virtual Academy and Channel 9. They have a lot of videos on this. I know if you're looking specifically for like the compute resources, and even more than just compute, I know they have a weekly show, Tuesdays with Corey. And Corey Sanders is the gentleman in charge of the compute area. And he's got a great show. It's a great way to keep up with things.
Yeah.
Okay, lots of resources.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay, very good. What are the trends in data management and data solutions that Azure offers?
Oh, okay.
That's a good one.
A couple of trends. One is the separation of compute and storage, right? And so traditionally, in traditional like data warehouses or data management, your compute and your storage is kind of together. Now, big data, let me back up a little bit. Separate the world into more of traditional data warehousing, which is this more relational focused, moving through a staging to a data warehouse, to data marts, to give users insights and analytic capabilities. And then there was the more of a big data approach that the open source kind of pioneered, which was more of a data lake type scenario where I ingest all the data through IoT type methods into a common storage, and then I use the data to drive my analytics. And so those two worlds have kind of come together, and so you see the relational products overlapping into the big data space, and you see that with some of the new features in SQL, for example, for ADW, for Azure Data Warehouse. Sorry, I'll use acronyms. The Azure Data Warehouse, where I can create external tables that are sitting on HDFS or something like that. And then the big data world has actually moved closer to the relational with a lot of different products where, here's how I can serve my users from an interactive capability standpoint instead of batch jobs like a traditional Hadoop.
Mm-hmm.
So these two worlds have come together. The trends I see are separation of compute and storage. Basically, why pay for compute if you're just storing, and why, you know, if you need high compute and low storage, you can do that too.
Mm-hmm.
I see the data lake as a pattern that I see a lot of enterprises gaining a lot of speed, which is get all the data in and then make my analytical decisions based upon the data rather than leaving it on the cutting floor. That's another one I see. What else? I don't know. Those are the two things I see that are basically the biggest things out there. Using Azure, we have a number of different products: Blob Store, Cold Store, for very inexpensive storage of data. You can think of something like Azure Data Lake Store, which I kind of think of as like a premium storage capability. We can run ADL, Azure Data Lake Analytics on top of that, which is more of a batch service right now, or job service right now, that can drive insights, and that kind of has its origins in something that we had internally called Cosmos. I can use Azure Data Warehouse. Azure Data Warehouse, I can create external tables. Like I said, in the financial space, one of the big things we're moving towards is we had this traditional revenue reporting system that we were using traditional data warehouses. So we had, 2,000 sources. We brought them into big SQL servers. We processed them into other SQL servers called, for preparation and transformation, and then a bunch of different marks so people could make management decisions about revenue that Microsoft makes. We're changing that. We've kind of turned that upside down, and we're moving to a more open source stack. We're actually using Spark Streaming, and so we're basically taking ingestion through an event hub and using Spark Streaming pipelines to process the data and get data to the user. So the advantage to the individual finance users are, I used to see data refreshed every day, and now I'm going to see it refreshed every 10 minutes, right? And so that's a pretty eye-opening experience. Now there's some things you have to do to get there. One is have a conversation with the finance people around what eventual consistency means, and that term kind of gives them a little pause sometimes.
But eventual consistency. Tell us what it means.
So it just means that the data, so in a streaming pipeline, the data will be eventually consistent and correct. And so, but
so not initially, but
yeah. So
eventually.
So in other words, what I explained to them is that it's okay, in 5 minutes it'll all be correct, mm-hmm. right? Not necessarily, but you don't necessarily need the most accurate data to make a decision, right? I need to know what the trend is. I need to predict what's going to happen. I don't necessarily need to know the final answer to make a decision. And so, would you like data that is 2% off right now, or you want to wait 24 hours till it's perfect? Right?
What's their answer?
It really depends. Field salespeople, they want to know, I'm going into a customer's site, I want to know, what the customer's doing right now, right? Versus maybe a corporate controller who wants to say, no, I need to report to the SEC. I need it to be right.
Right.
Exactly. So those are two different
totally
things. So
that.
We're trying to solve for both of those problems. So yeah. the trend I was going with is using more modern methods, modern data warehouse methods, to provide analytics for our customers and our business.
Okay.
Sorry.
Very well.
Long talk.
I just think it's phenomenal, the number of options that are now available.
Oh,
if you think of
huge.
The conversation you just had around data and data store and data processing, and if you think of traditional on-prem, if you had to set up all of those architectures and provide solutions, would be, significantly costly to set up, and then significantly costly to maintain.
Absolutely.
And then, you'd likely would never achieve your full utilization. Whereas in the cloud, you have all of those options readily available to you. You can plug and play as you need, and then, and then you can manage the scaling and the right sizing on all of that. So I think it's just phenomenal. All of the technologies you just mentioned to be able to, from an IT perspective, to be able to enable business is much more enriching in the cloud.
Yeah. And one of the great things, like we've talked about before, around the optimization, I brought up like that Hadoop cluster that the Skype for Business team's using. They turn it on for like 30 minutes once a week.
Yeah.
Instead of having these servers running all the time, chugging through this data, they just go, boom, do this one big data load, and then they have lots of data to look at for the whole week. And they're finding a lot of different trends, including they're finding, in some cases, it may not be Skype for Business's problem. It may be a network issue. It could be a Wi-Fi issue.
Sure.
And they can actually see that because of that data, the way they can now play with it.
One final question. How do we manage our Azure subscriptions, Brent?
Oh, that's a great great question. So, so Azure subscriptions are kind of another piece of inventory. So when we start started the IT journey 5-6 years ago. We centralized the subscription creation. I think at one point we had 2,500 Azure subscriptions for MSIT. So just like on-prem servers, 30% of them are not being used. Mm-hmm. So we've moved to a model now where, well, let me step back. So what we did in the past was we did a subscription per application, per environment. So if we have an app A, dev environment, test environment, prod environment, UAT environment, there are 4 subscriptions. So that kind of helped with the bloat of subscription counts. So we're moving to a model in that, so we have what's called a service. Underneath the service are a collection of applications, anywhere from 1 to 30. So now with ARM, with Resource Manager, we're able to create 1 subscription per service, use resource groups underneath that subscription to isolate application and environment combinations. So instead of 2,500 to manage, we're going to be down to somewhere around 300 for the IT total. So, you know, it gets you to a clean inventory, gets, we're moving the accountability of the ownership over to the project teams rather than the central IT team to manage, get the costs in front of the right people, get them accountable for their spend, their utilization. Yeah. Just a lot of benefits of moving to that kind of slim down.
With the Azure Resource Manager, the RBAC model, the RBAC capabilities of segregation of the resource groups is incredibly powerful for separation, right?
And RBAC is?
Roles-based access control.
All right.
So, and one of the great things is as you start taking a look at these newer models with the subscriptions, early on we tried to do a whole bunch of centralized subscriptions. And then we had to build a management tool on top of it. We chose to use Windows Azure Pack. Mind you, this was back before ARM came out. We were in the classic mode of Azure. Now that we have the role-based access control capabilities and the Azure resource management model of Azure, we can now easily hand that, like Brent said, to the teams and make them very responsible for it. And that's the direction we're going, is to put the responsibility down to the teams and say, here it is, here's your subscription, now manage it as you would manage any finance, and here, you know, try to get here, block them, here's your budget. Eventually we will get to a point and say, here's your budget, you operate within that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And even downward pressure helps people be more efficient.
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
So you get, be more efficient next year than you were today.
Yep.
We are near the end of our hour, and I do want to ask our SMEs one final question. What is the one tip you would like to leave our customers with today? How about we start with you, Brent?
So the primary thing that I'd like to leave you with is when you're moving to Azure, don't treat it as an extension of on-prem, and really take advantage of what Azure has to offer in the scalability, the elasticity of Azure. You know, a perfect example is when you turn your lights off, or when you leave the room at home, you're going to turn your lights off. Do the same with your Azure VMs. You know, use Azure how it's intended to be used.
Excellent point, yeah. My tip would be, as enterprises are thinking about Azure, clearly understand the organizational goals and strategy for the cloud, and then ensure that the prioritization of adoption of the cloud maps to those goals. So a natural prioritization tends to be move as much as you can to SaaS, then take a look at PaaS, and then use IaaS as a last resort. IaaS has valuable scenarios, particularly for Microsoft IT, where we're exiting data centers. One other tip, actually, that I always leave customers is leverage also Microsoft and Microsoft Services has a wealth of information. There was a wealth of patterns and practices, best practices from other enterprises, and also best practices that come from Microsoft itself. And so leverage the Microsoft Services, the account team, the technical service roles. They will absolutely help you in terms of getting to the cloud efficiently, effectively.
I think I would like to point out is, as you're moving into build on Joe and Brent's statements, there's definitely some cost benefits from using the cloud. But I would like to leave you with, when you're making the migration to the cloud, make sure you look at the capabilities of your services and your applications and take advantage of those new capabilities that Azure provides to provide business value. We're all undergoing this digital transformation, and being able to take advantage of, hey, I can throw ML on my data problem and provide some faster insights or better insights, whether it be forecasting in the financial space or hiring in the HR space.
Machine learning.
Or the ability to basically use distributed processing, that separation of compute and storage. Take advantage of those capabilities. It will help you in the future provide more business value, not just cost savings. So cost savings is one big piece, business value is another piece for me.
I guess the biggest takeaway for me to tell everyone is to help people embrace the modern engineering world. Part of that could be take a look at, as you're moving from on-prem type office systems to the cloud, take a look at your governance systems. You might want to rethink your governance at that point, because as you're moving from on-prem to the cloud, it's a perfect time to review things. And as you're moving, you can be in a hybrid model and utilize those over that hybrid model. Modern engineering also can be impactful in the Azure space, because try and take advantage of the newer technologies that Azure provides. Try and take lose some of the old thoughts, like Brent said, of you don't need to have spare servers. You can do just-in-time deployment. You can start with the smallest SKU and then build up your service instead of getting the biggest ones. And these are some areas I can even say in MSIT, we did the exact opposite, and we have paid for it at times. Yeah. So we've learned those lessons the hard way. Learn from us, so that you don't have to.
Very good. We are at the end of our hour, and I do want to thank our SMEs for taking time away from your day jobs to come talk to our customers. It's truly a great thing that you do. And I want to thank our customers for joining us today. We love the questions and the dialogue and the opportunity to come talk to you. You can find this video posted at Microsoft.com/ITShowcase, along with a wealth of informational technical case studies, business case studies. Robert referred to a lot about from finance. There are a lot of them out there. We also give you our productivity guides. These are how we bring Microsoft's employees up to speed on the latest and greatest software every day. We provide them to you to use in your own organizations. We have live events every week, so please join us, come back, and bring your colleagues. Thank you, and have a great day.